You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it is Thursday. However, we are going to have Senator Bernie Sanders with us right this very second for our Brunch with Bernie, typically Friday, National Town Hall meeting. We're going to do it today on Thursday. Senator Sanders, greetings.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you. Before we get into the politics and your thoughts on the day, I just wanted to, if I may, let everybody know that my new book, The Crash of 2016, The Plot to Destroy America and What We Can Do to Stop It, is now available for pre-order at all the usual suspects, you know, Powell's.com and Amazon.com and things like that, and that you were kind enough to write a blurb for it. It's three sentences long. Do you mind if I read it?
Please.
Okay. This is what Senator Sanders said. Tom Hartman is right that America must invest in our transportation and energy infrastructure, promote renewable energy, and rethink the disastrous trade policies that have shuttered our factories and decimated our middle class. I hope his thoughtful ideas about what America needs and his loud and clear warning about where America is headed will wake us up before his prediction comes true. And Tom Hayden and Jeff Cohen and Richard Trumka and Van Jones and Leo DiCaprio, a number of other people have given nice blurbs for it, but yours is my favorite, Bernie. Thank you so much.
Well, Tom, that's what I wrote, and that's what I believe. You are focusing, and have for many years, unlike many other people in the media, on the issues that face working families, and you have come up with many ideas as to how we can transform our economy so that it works well for everybody and not just the 1%. So I congratulate you on the book.
Thank you. Thank you. And the book, again, is The Crash of 2016, and it's available today, starting today, for pre-order. So if you're curious, check it out. Anyhow, self-indulgent promos aside, what's going on in the world, Bernie? Senator Sanders.
Self-advertising is always a good thing.
Yeah, I suppose.
A lot that's going on. I want to mention to folks what I know they already know, that on August 28th, we'll be celebrating the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s extraordinary speech in Washington. And it seems to me, as we reflect on that, that there is much that King would have been proud of that has happened since his death. I mean, I suspect very strongly he would have had real doubts about this country electing an African-American president in that period of time and reelecting him with a good vote. And I think a lot of the legal barriers to segregation and discrimination have been broken down. God knows that we still have a long way to go. But I think, as a nation, I think we should feel good about moving toward a day when we're judging people on their character, which is what King talked about, and not on the color of their skin, whether that's African-Americans, whether that's women, whether that's gays, whether that's Hispanics, whoever it may be. I think as a nation, we have made some real progress. But I think what the media often doesn't focus on in terms of King is that he was not only a great leader in terms of opposing segregation, but he was also very, very mindful of economic discrimination and inequality. And he talked during the course of his life about the need for radical economic and political transformation of America. And I hope that everybody remembers that when he was killed in Memphis, Tennessee, he wasn't there for a quote-unquote civil rights demonstration. He was there in defense of sanitation workers, the guys who collected the garbage, who were trying to form a union, who were receiving very low wages, whose working conditions were horrendous. Some of them had been killed on the job shortly before King was there. And he was fighting for their economic rights. And also, in the last months of his life, and again, it's not widely reported in the media, he was working on a poor people's march. Do you remember that, Tom?
I do. I was a kid, but I remember it very well.
And what the poor people's march was about is what King was saying. Again, this was not a quote-unquote civil rights issue. What he was saying is, I want blacks, and I want whites, and I want Native Americans, and I want Hispanics, and I want everybody in this country to come to Washington to fight against poverty. And he was saying that in a nation as rich as we were, How does it happen that so many children and workers are living in poverty? How does it happen that we are spending huge sums of money in the war in Vietnam then, or on military purposes, and yet we don't have enough money to provide health care, education, or take care of the needs of the most vulnerable among us? So the point that I want to make here is that King, of course, played an extraordinary role in breaking down the barriers of segregation. But he should also be remembered in ways that the media often chooses not to remember him, as a great and valiant fighter for economic rights, not only for African Americans, but for all the American people, and also somebody who was concerned not only about the war in Vietnam in his time, strongly opposed to it, but against a very inflated military budget where he saw the needs in this country being ignored. So that's one of the issues that I hope we will think about as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Another issue that is gaining attention is that we're seeing a lot of young people who are working at fast food restaurants around this country are beginning to stand up and fight back against horrendously low wages. Many of these folks are earning $7.25, $7.50, $8 an hour. Often they're not even able to get 40 hours a week, and very often they have minimal or no benefits at all. And what they are doing in the fast food industry and raising these issues is really focusing a broader spotlight on one of the great economic crises of our country, which is not only that unemployment is much, much too high, but that a huge percentage of the new jobs that are being created are low-wage jobs, at wages that people just cannot live on. And in fact, an increasing number of these jobs are part-time jobs. Something like 75% of the new jobs created during the last year are part-time jobs, less than 30 hours a week, often with no benefits. So I applaud these young people for standing up in the fast food industry, taking on McDonald's and Burger King. Clearly where that leads us is the need to have a much higher minimum wage than we have right now. Right now, the minimum wage is nationally $7.25 an hour. Many states have gone higher than that, including the state of Vermont, which is now at $8.60 an hour. But we should have a minimum wage of at least $10.10 an hour, and I'm working with Senator Harkin and some other people on that. Also, what we have learned recently is there are hundreds of thousands of American workers who are working for federal contractors with federal money that goes to contractors or subcontractors who are paid abysmally low wages. And that's an issue we want to focus on. So the bottom line here is that when we think about the economy, we often think about high unemployment, which is in real terms about 14%. It's much higher for people of color. It is higher for young people. But we should also focus on the fact that many of the jobs are low-wage jobs, and we need to substantially raise the minimum wage. Another issue that has been out there in the last week is there was a report from the folks who are working on global warming, the IPCC, and their report was leaked, and I guess it still needs more work. But what they are concluding, which is no shock to anybody, is that with 95% probability, global warming is man-made, despite what the Koch brothers and the well-paid people deniers are saying. And that also the real fear is that as the temperature of the planet rises, we're going to be seeing major cities in the United States and around the world being flooded or in some cases underwater. So global warming is an issue that we have got to stay focused on as well.
It's our Brunch with Bernie hour a day early. You can give Bernie a call right now, our national town hall meeting. Brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls today on Thursday, right now live.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. And you can walk into your local bookstore and pre-order my new book, The Crash of 2016, today. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. Tom Hartman Program, and it's our Brunch with Bernie. Today, it's Thursday, yes, and we're live, and Senator Sanders is with us a day early today, so he's taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. And Tony, in Dana Point, California, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Tom and Senator. It's an honor. My question is, Senator, is there a way that we could make a law or come up with a law where the investment banks that are that have fiduciary responsibility, like the FDIC, that they'd have to put it in their title or letters, or does that make sense?
I'm not sure that I understood the question.
The fiduciary responsibility, in other words, the investment firms that put their clients' investments ahead of their own.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yes, of course. I mean, you know, Congress can pass any law that it wants to. And I think what Tony's concern is that at the end of the day, what many of the Wall Street concerns are worried about is their own money, less so than their clients. And I think he's certainly right about that.
Okay. Laura in Sebring, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. I wanted to ask a question. I'm a little bit confused. When they passed the Affordable Care Act, didn't they make that mandatory spending? I mean, how can you defund something that's mandatory?
Defunding, you mean some states are not going through with the expansion of Medicaid?
Or do you mean Ted Cruz campaign?
I mean, Ted Cruz is trying to defund it.
But if it's mandatory,
how can you do that?
It's not going to happen, and that I can assure you. Theoretically, it can happen. I mean, if the United States Congress decided to defund Social Security or Medicare tomorrow and the president signed the bill, that's what would happen. Congress can do anything it wants to do. Clearly, from the point of view of Cruz and other extreme right-wing members of the Congress, they are satisfied with the status quo in healthcare in America. We have 50 million people who have no health insurance, and for many years the cost was soaring. And we lose some 35,000-40,000 people every year because they can't get to a doctor on time. And these guys don't want any change at all. And they're there to protect the insurance companies. So to answer your question, Laura, yeah, theoretically it can, but I think the Republicans in the House have something like tried to defund it 37 or 38 times. It's not going to happen.
Kathy in Valparaiso, Indiana. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Senator. My name is Kathy Kahn, and this is pertaining to something that Mr. Hartman brought up yesterday. There was a point that was missed about the welfare system working for welfare. What happened in Indiana was it wasn't only set up for people to go to work, but to get a higher education so they could become financially independent. But what happened was what I call a lot of pop-up universities, a lot of daycare centers, programs like that were set up to be federally funded. And what happened was they scammed the system, but the poor people were the ones that paid the price for it.
Yep. Yeah. Well, Kathy,
that's what I'm seeing happening now at a bigger level by the federal government. And couple other points I wanted to make was once a person got any assistance from the government and you were financially independent, you were supposed to reimburse the monies that you had when you weren't able to. When you had to request for assistance.
Kathy, can you summarize a single question for Senator Sanders to answer?
Okay, my point is, if the corporations are getting welfare, whatever you call it, assistance, why aren't they paying it back?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, for many, many years, in many, many ways, corporations have been living high on the hog. Off of the federal government. We can spend 2 hours just discussing that issue. One area where we've seen just incredible ripoffs has been in the Defense Department, where contractors have said, okay, we'll build a weapon system or we'll build a plane for X billion dollars, and it turns out that the cost overruns are just extraordinary. We end up spending billions more, not to mention that there's just an enormous amount of dishonesty, fraudulent billing, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, Kathy, your point is well taken. I think you have a situation where many corporations are taking major advantage and benefiting from their relationship to the federal government.
Pat in Beloit, Wisconsin. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I had one question, but I'm going to change it and ask you another question. how do we do something about this redistricting that's taken place in many states that makes Senate or congressional seats just a lock, and they've been done in such a manner that they are not even racially representing the people, and I you know, it's like we never will be able to get these people out of office.
Well, I think two things. I think to the degree that they have violated voting rights, the Voting Rights Act, which, as you know, has been significantly changed by a recent Supreme Court decision, we want to see the Attorney General of the United States be active in that area to protect the voting rights of citizens. But the other way, you know, Pat, is the old-fashioned way. I do not accept the argument that these guys cannot be beaten, even after they gerrymandered their districts. Look, the truth of the matter is that there are very few states in this country, there are no states in this country, where the vast majority of the people are not working people who are hurting today. And what the right wing has done a brilliant job on is deflecting attention from the real issues impacting people, and that is low wages, unemployment, lack of educational opportunity for their kids, inadequate health care, and so forth and so on, and move that into issues like gay rights or guns or abortion and so forth. And our job is to put together a progressive agenda, speak to working people, and mobilize people. You know, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Finish your thought there, Bernie.
Well, I mean, I think we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of a time when hundreds of thousands of people flocked to Washington to demand justice.
It's talk media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. And today, a day early, we're doing brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. You're still here with us?
I am right here.
Great. In fact, I forgot to put you on hold during the break. My apologies, although you were potted down, so all is good. Let's see here. Kent in Salt Lake City, Utah. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders, congratulations on the great work you do. And good for you for bringing up the fact that Martin Luther King took a stand for the poor, and he was against the war in Vietnam, things that are ignored by the mass media. Another thing that's ignored by the mass media is the Social Security tax. And my question is, how come I don't hear progressives bring up the fact that if somebody makes over $113,700, after that, they don't have to pay any more Social Security tax? You know, it's a very regressive tax, and I don't hear progressives talk about it, and I would like to know what your opinion is as to why that is.
Well, Kent, that's a great question, and I think Tom and I have talked about that for years, and I have legislation in that would do exactly what you're talking about. What Kent is saying is that if you want to make Social Security solvent not just for the next 20 years, but you want to make it solvent for the next 50 or 75 years, the fairest way to do that is simply lift the cap. Right now, if somebody makes $1 million a year, or somebody makes $113,000 a year, they're both contributing exactly the same amount into the Social Security Trust Fund. So we have legislation in that, in fact, would lift the cap and make Social Security solvent for our kids and our grandchildren. So some of us do talk about it, Kent. I've got legislation in that would do just that, but your point is exactly right.
John in Minneapolis, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to ask the senator, with the sequestration of Medicare, I've heard from some friends that it really is impacting hospitals negatively, and I wanted to know exactly how much money is being taken from Medicare by the sequestration. That's my question.
Well, in terms of Medicare, what is not being cut are benefits, but what is being cut are reimbursements. Reimbursement to hospitals, and I believe that's about 2%, if I'm not mistaken, and that is a lot of money, and in fact is having a negative impact on hospitals in Vermont and around the country. Sequestration is a disastrous and stupid idea because it makes across-the-board cuts and doesn't prioritize as the best way to cut. What some of us are working on, and I'm a member of the Budget Committee, is a budget which ends sequestration by raising significant sums of revenue from the wealthiest people in this country, whose effective tax rate is low, and also from corporate America, where you have one out of four major corporations not paying a nickel in taxes. And it was, if you look at corporate taxation, the collective amount of money that's coming into the Treasury from corporations, it's much less today than it was in past history. So there are ways to deal with the deficit, and we've made good progress, by the way, but one way you don't do it is not only by cutting back on Medicare, but by cutting back on the Meals on Wheels program, cutting back on Head Start, forcing federal employees in some cases to take a day off, a week, a 20% cut in pay. Those are not rational ways to deal with deficit reduction.
Lori in New Lothrop, Michigan. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, thank you. I'd like to thank Senator Sanders for all the work that he does in Congress. I really appreciate it. My point is, I'm a laid-off teacher in Michigan, and with education funding being the mess that it is, I'm unlikely to find another teaching position anytime soon. So I'm relying on unemployment compensation. As part of the budget negotiations coming up this fall, is unemployment compensation going to be part of those talks?
The answer is, if you can think of horrendous regressive ideas, our friends in the Republican Party were there before you and they've already thought of it. So to answer your question, yes. Let's be very clear about the dynamic of politics in America today in dealing with Lori's issue. First of all, it pains me that we have a laid-off teacher in this country. We need more teachers, we need more child care workers, and we should not be laying off teachers when we have the crisis in education that we have today. But second of all, in terms of unemployment, you have a Republican Party which is determined to protect the interests of the wealthy and the powerful, and not only do they want to defend the tax breaks and the loopholes that currently exist, including all of these tax havens that we see in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, and elsewhere, which enable multinational corporations to avoid huge amounts of taxation. These guys want to give them even more. So if your goal is to move toward deficit reduction, if your goal is to give more tax breaks to the wealthy, then the only way you do that is by making horrendous cuts in every single program that is of meaning to working families. And that's precisely what the Ryan budget in the House of Representatives does. That's what the Republican budget does. So, Lori, to answer your question, do I have any doubt that these guys would want to have already made efforts and will want to expand upon those efforts to cut back on unemployment? Absolutely.
Zach in Fort Dodge, Iowa. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Zach.
Hi, Senator. How are you doing this afternoon? I'm calling. Why aren't we using the IRS to go after these companies? I mean, it seems like our government's kind of got the tools. And I mean, if we can target specific groups with the IRS, why aren't we?
Well, the answer is, let me respond to that in two ways, Zach. Number one, historically and interestingly enough, the Republicans have wanted to underfund the IRS precisely for the reason that they do not want the IRS to have the capabilities, to have the lawyers, to have the accountants, to get involved in complicated cases where large corporations who have zillions of accountants and lawyers may be avoiding their fair share of taxes. So when these guys say, let's cut back on the IRS, what they're really saying, let's make sure that we're going to protect multinational and powerful corporations from paying their fair share of taxes. Second point is that in some cases it is not an issue of the IRS. In some cases, what companies are doing who are avoiding taxes, and if you go to my website, sanders.senate.gov, you will find, I think we have a page there just devoted to the many, many companies that pay nothing or very little in taxes. They do it legally. So it's not an issue of evading the law. It's a question of simply taking advantage of the law, and the law has got to be changed. In one area, we've introduced legislation, which is perhaps the great scandal of our time, is that with one out of four major corporations not paying a nickel in taxes, we have to address the issue of tax havens in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda, where these guys are storing billions and billions of dollars and not paying a nickel of taxes on those profits. So there are a lot of ways that we can go after them. Some of it is through a beefed up IRS, but some of them is just changing tax law.
Ken, in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Tom. Senator, I went through 2 years of trying to get Social Security disability. Back in January, they said I'm disabled by mental defect, but I was denied the disability. So I'm living on supplemental income, which is parsed out to me. And I'm just guessing, but most senators probably spend more on their dinner, like they will tonight, than I get for a month's income. I do not understand why Social Security treats people like they are criminals, and they act like a prosecutorial body instead of the people they are supposed to be, those who are paid only to help. And they treat applicants like they are guilty of something.
Ken, let me just say this. I am certainly not going to defend every person in the Social Security Administration, and I'm sure you have abusive and rude people there. But generally speaking, the problems that you refer to are not from the Social Security employees. Those workers do not determine what the benefits are. That's something that the United States Congress determines. And one of the issues, Ken, I want to inform you about, although I suspect you know about it, is right now, if you think the situation with Social Security is bad now, you should know what a number of people in Congress have in mind to do, and that is move forward to what is called a chained CPI, a new configuration to determine cost of living benefits. And if they get their way, and I am working very, very hard, helping to lead the effort to stop that approach. If they get their way and transform how we determine what Social Security COLAs are, if for a regular Social Security beneficiary, if you're 65 today, you will lose about $650 a year by the time you're 75. And if you're a disabled veteran, you will be losing in your lifetime many, many thousands of dollars. So the fight right now, Ken, that we're engaged in is to make sure that a bad situation does not become even worse.
And Senator, we just have about 30 seconds before the break here. Do you think that your colleagues, particularly your Democratic colleagues, are going to stand up to both the Republicans and sometimes the president?
The president has been very bad. He has kind of led with this issue. I think to answer your question, Tom, I can't give you a definitive answer, but I think we are making ground. We are gaining ground on this. I think the American people are very clear that at a time when so many folks have lost their pensions, when so many people have inadequate retirement security right now, don't have enough money in the bank, it is absolutely imperative that we protect Social Security and not money.
It's Brunch with Bernie, a day early this week. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls here Thursday on the Tom Hartman Program, our National Town Hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Everything from petitions to a great news resource, plus Bernie's newsletter, Bernie Buzz.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And just a quick FYI, my new book, which is coming out in November, it's called The Crash of 2016, is now available for pre-order at Amazon and every place else. Welcome back. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, a day early here on the Tom Hartman Program. Thursdays, Senator Sanders taking your calls, and Joan in Auburn, Washington. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, well, first of all, Senator Sanders, I want to thank you so much for all the work that you do on our behalf. We really appreciate you.
Thank you very much.
My question is, why has there not been legislation? I would have thought when President Obama first went in, one of the first things they would address was the fact that Medicare cannot negotiate prices with the pharmaceutical companies. I expected that would be, everybody said they want to save money,
yep,
but that would be one of the biggest places they could save money. Why hasn't there been legislation introduced to do that?
Well, legislation has been introduced. And in fact, legislation has been discussed for a long, long time on that issue. And the answer is very simple, and that is the pharmaceutical industry does not want this, and they are very powerful. Right now, what Joan is talking about is that in the Department of Defense and in the Veterans Administration and the Indian Health Service, they are purchasing prescription drugs at relatively low rates because they're negotiating with the pharmaceutical industry. When the Medicare Part D legislation was written by Republicans, by and large, they were very explicit about making sure that we protect the profits of the pharmaceutical industry and not negotiate prices. But Jonah's exactly right. If we negotiate prices, we can save substantial sums of money for the government. And in general, beyond that, we've got to end the absurdity of Americans being forced to pay by far the highest prices in the world for their prescription drugs. It is a very serious health problem in this country, because if you talk to doctors, they will tell you that quite often their working-class patients are simply unable to afford the prescription drugs that these doctors are prescribing.
Robert in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Robert?
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you for taking my call, and my applause to Senator Sanders, and to you, Bernie, and to you, Tom. I wanted to ask Senator Sanders' opinion of one of my pet peeves is that we need to increase the amount of exposure that we have to from our legislature. The FDR proposal that Tom talks about many times, when FDR talked about a new Bill of Rights,
I think that
five important things could be added as amendments to our Constitution that would bring this about. As Tom talks about the amendment that people, that money is not speech, and that corporations are not people, those two.
Yep.
We need a third amendment that I would like Senator Sanders' opinion about, that every single dollar that is added to a campaign of an elected official must be exposed as to the source of that single dollar.
Okay, Robert, that's a lot. Let's let Bernie comment on these things. Thank you, Robert.
Very, very important questions. Very important questions. It will take us more time than we have to really get into them. The first point, I think, has to do when Roosevelt was alive. He talked about an economic Bill of Rights, an economic Bill of Rights. You know, there's a lot of discussion now from my conservative friends about freedom, freedom. And you got many Republicans today, and this is really true, who not only oppose raising the minimum wage, they oppose the concept of the minimum wage, because their definition of freedom is that if you're in a high unemployment area and somebody will hire you at $3 an hour, that's freedom. Because the government is not involved, there is no minimum wage, and you and your employer have just worked it out, and you are working for $3 an hour. That's freedom. And if you are working 60 or 70 hours a week without overtime, that's freedom, because the government shouldn't be involved in mandating overtime. Or if the working conditions in your establishment is terrible, that's freedom. Well, I think what Robert is talking about is a very fundamental and philosophical discussion that we need to have. If you today are unemployed and you don't have a job and you don't have any income, are you a free person? What does freedom mean? If you are sick and you can't get into a doctor's office, is that what freedom is about? And I think what most Americans understand, not all, to be sure, is that freedom is not just the right to vote every 4 years, although many of our Republican friends are working hard to disenfranchise many, many people. It's not just freedom of speech, especially at a time when the corporate world controls a lot of, you know, radio and television and the internet. But freedom also means basic economic rights, that if you are one of the vast majority of the American people struggling to keep your heads above water, if you can't afford to send your kid to college, if you can't afford to pay your rent, your mortgage, are you really living in freedom? What does freedom mean? And I think there are other countries around the world that understand that economic security is an essential part of what freedom is about, that people have a right to have health care, that if you don't have a job, they have a right to a strong unemployment compensation system, that when you get old, you have the right to a strong retirement program, that if you are a baby, in a sense, you have the right to get good quality child care so you have a fair start in life. So I think, you know, Robert raises a question, Tom, that, you know, maybe at some point we could spend a whole program on, and that is, what does freedom really mean? And does it go beyond simply the political right to vote or the right to read what you want? That's freedom. That's important. People have fought and died for those freedoms. But I happen to believe that when you talk about freedom, you're also talking about economic rights as well. And FDR did talk about that.
That was a brilliant soliloquy. Senator Sanders, Bernie, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Take care.
Great having you. And don't forget, you can check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. And you can check out my brand new book. It's pre-released today, The Crash of 2016, at your favorite bookseller. Check in with your bookstore or online store, whatever you'd like. The Crash of 2016 by Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mike Papantonio is on the line with us. The I'm missing an adjective. I was going to say but I don't know how to pronounce that word. Eupontymou. Anyway, the host of ringoffireradio.com and a brilliant attorney. Pap, welcome back to the program.
How are you, Tom?
I am fine. It's nice to have you with us. I understand that you are all over Texas water and fracking and the IRS going after and not going after churches. Can I open that rant for you?
Two incredible stories. First of all, Texas is burning up. It's dry as a bone. And the frackers are continuing to frack Texas. Now we learned that they used about 630 million gallons of water that Texas doesn't have in order to get about 440 million gallons of oil out of the ground. It's so bad down there right now, Tom, that you have people living in areas like San Angelo that are having to pipe 60 miles just to bring water into their little city, little area there. Las Cruces, they had to drill 1,000 feet after they tried to drill into land next to them to try to bring water in. And it's very clear what's happening. Fracking is using anywhere, the low number is six million gallons per fracking operation, as high as 10 million. And the frackers, of course, the question comes up, well, can't you just use recycled water? And they say, well, no, it's not cost efficient. In other words, it's going to cost them another 3 cents per gallon, so they would rather use everybody's fresh water.
Well, isn't it also, once they've used that fracking water, it's so toxic that even handling it or having the fumes be getting out around the workers would make it so deadly that...
It's toxic to the point, Tom, that they have to drill about 1,000 feet below the ground just to put it in the ground, and now they're finding that when they drill, there's cracks around aquifers, and the toxins are ending up in the aquifers and coming up through people's wells. So I guess the worst part of the story is the politicians in Texas. Of course, the position is this has nothing to do with global climate change, and we need to study this more. And while they're studying it, the entire state is absolutely drying up to a bone. 30 communities around West Texas area will run out of water by the end of the year. And Rick Perry says, we don't think we really have a problem here. People are making this into something that it's not. And what he fails to mention is that 74% of Texas is now involved in what they consider a severe drought that is so irreversible that once the aquifer is recharged, it uses up the water too quick to stay ahead of the recharge.
And the Rio Grande doesn't even run to the Pacific anymore,
no,
does it? I mean,
no,
the big rivers, that's the biggest.
So the point is they want to continue the study. They're having to haul water into Austin, Texas. Around Austin, Texas, you have these resort areas like Spicewood Beach. They don't even have water to give to the guests when they get to Spicewood Beach. They have to haul it in 40 or 50 miles away. The worst part about it is that's not where it ends. In order to make all this happen, they're tearing the roads up so completely, Tom. They're tearing up paved roads. They don't have a tax base to be able to repave the roads, so they're using gravel and rock on what used to be paved roads now for tens and tens of miles and hundreds of miles in some part of the state because the tax base is non-existent. The trucks that are used for fracking have done such damage to the roads, but there's no tax base to pay for that infrastructure.
So let me get this straight. Because Texas does not have a state income tax, which the billionaires and millionaires, it's why George Herbert Walker Bush kept that apartment in Texas all those years when he was living in Connecticut and said, I'm a Texas resident. Remember Ray Trudeau, Doonesbury, making jokes about that? Yeah. You too can be a Texas resident. Because Texas does not have a state income tax, their infrastructure is not only just kind of crumbling, it's actually physically, intentionally being degraded back to 19th century, 18th century standards. They're turning paved roads into dirt roads?
Exactly. Paved roads that had been there for, you know, decades and decades. Now they say, well, gee whiz, we know the fracking trucks have destroyed all the roads, but we don't have enough money to pay for it. The other thing that's happening, people don't understand really even how fracking works, but basically it's a blend of fresh water with sand and toxins that are so mysterious, Tom, that when the fracking industry was sued to try to disclose what the toxins are, they refused to even tell us what was in the toxins.
These poisonous chemicals that are petroleum distillates, so we know that they're carcinogens at the very least. But amazing.
But you wonder, Texas isn't getting a lot of sympathy from, when you take a look at this story, Texas is not getting a lot of sympathy about this because there is the notion that it's self-imposed. They've brought so much of this on their own, and it is corporations are simply continuing to just obliterate the state. And in the process, Tom, Texas is in a decline financially. You know, I don't know if you followed the stories where they're trying to prop up, gee whiz, our economy is so great. Go to Dallas. Mm-hmm. We're just such a great example of what economic policy should look like. The truth behind that story is the infrastructure is in decline. The tax base is in decline. When this third part of it, when the environment gets so bad that people have to live in a damn desert simply to live, the decline is absolutely underway. When you have to use gravel roads to get around in a state like Texas, it's a bad signal.
Yeah, that's amazing. And the IRS, you wanted to talk about the IRS not going after churches that are violating campaign.
Yeah, it was a great ruling that came out of Wisconsin. A very capable federal judge up there said you had an organization called the Freedom from Religion Foundation that had sued the IRS, and they said, you know what, the IRS has failed to do anything about the overreaching of these churches in the political process. In other words, 501c3 says a couple of things, Tom. First of all, it says a church doesn't even have to be specific. They don't need to fill out all the papers that other 501c3 organizations have to fill out to get that status. But once they get the status, the trade-off is supposed to be, we're going to allow you to do this, provided you engage in educational or religious or scientific or other charitable kind of undertakings. We're going to allow you not to pay taxes. And there's one other thing you must not do. You must not in any way be involved in any communications, any effort to put your church in the middle of politics. What's happened is you have a part of the religious movement that is deliberately flaunting this issue. They're trying to say, come after us. We dare you. There's stories where you have preachers in the South that are telling Democrats that they're no longer welcome in the church. You have churches, Southern Baptist primarily churches, that are handing out political leaflets, actually finding them in the pews during an election cycle. They're giving speeches from the pews about who they should vote for. And the point is this, the IRS it has failed to do anything about it because it's such a hot political issue. If you look at the facts are so overwhelming on the side of the IRS. There's no question at all that they would win this. And the truth is, we have to reconsider whether it's even relevant anymore to be giving these churches tax breaks like we've done historically. And I think it's a very important case. Freedom from Religion Foundation is approaching this very aggressively. I don't think it stops with this particular case against the IRS. I think they move towards saying we need to stop it entirely.
Yeah, I'm with you. I am of the opinion that, you know, outside of monasteries, or, you know, the actual charitable works, communities for abused kids or something that are run by churches, there should be no tax exemption.
Exactly.
You know, let's just do away with it.
Because we all pay for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Why should I be subsidizing them? Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com, and, of course, Ring of Fire TV, now on Free Speech TV.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, Pap, thanks so much for being with us. Ringoffireradio.com. Check it out. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. Just a quick reminder, my new book, The Crash of 2016. You've heard me talking about this for a year, year and a half. I've been writing this book. A lot went into this thing. And you can now hit your favorite online spot or your favorite bookstore, give them a call and pre-order. It's officially released in November. It'll be shipping in October, actually. The Crash of 2016 by Tom Hartman. So anyhow, it's Thursday. Let's get geeky on. This is my geeky science moment here. The 3 minutes Louise gives me every week to talk about my favorite stuff, which is science. Well, I love politics too. Anyhow, let's get geeky on generosity. According to new research, when you share your food with others, you may be subconsciously using a strategy to ensure that others will share their food with you one day should you find yourself down on your luck. In order to take a closer look at food sharing, researchers at the University of California, Santa Barbara, examined the food-sharing activity in monkeys, apes, and humans. The study compiled quantitative data on cooperative behaviors from all existing studies that were done on a whole wide variety of primate species. Adrian Jege, one of the lead researchers, said in a press release on the findings that, quote, "The meta-analysis clearly established that there is reciprocity in sharing, both among humans and among other primates, that retains significance even after controlling for other factors such as kinship, dominance relationships, and spatial proximity." We should have turned that into English for you. My apologies. Jegai went on to say that, quote, "Our findings support the idea that actions that benefit another individual tend to, ultimately, also benefit the giver, either because the recipient is genetically related to the giver or will eventually return the favor. Of course, the giver doesn't have to be consciously aware of the return benefits." So basically, the findings of the study suggest that humans and other primates form long-term relationships for mutual gain, and that benefits given other people are more likely to be returned when these long-term relationships are formed and maintained. It's possible that the findings of this study could reveal the motivations behind the food stamp program. By using our taxpayer dollars, for example, to help struggling Americans get the food they need to survive, we could be trying to ensure at some deep unconscious level, you know, kind of a DNA level, that if or when we're also in need of assistance, that assistance is going to be there to help us get it back on our feet. So as conservatives continue to wage war against the food stamps program, maybe they should think a little bit more about what would happen if the shoe were on the other foot. So our geeky science for the day. And this next hour is going to be, I hope, hysterical. Absolutely awesome. The guy who wrote the book about how Barack Obama is not a legitimate president because he was actually born in Kenya, the original birther, the guy who started the whole thing, Dr. Jerome Corsi, the guy who also wrote the Swift Boat Veterans book that started that whole thing, he's going to be with us in the next hour to talk about Ted Cruz. This is just going to be fun. Usually we're very serious and thoughtful about these things, but this is going to be, what this does is it reveals the essential racism of the Tea Party movement. You know, why is Donald Trump not running around screaming about Ted Cruz having a Cuban father and being born in Canada? Where's Donald Trump when you need him, right? Well, Ted Cruz is a white guy. So, anyhow, it's Anything Goes summer, and we just had Bernie. It almost feels like an Anything Goes Friday, but that's going to be tomorrow. But Anything Goes summer. So Wayne in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind today? You want to talk about the economy?
Yes. This I'm on the air, right?
You are.
Yes, Tom, good to talk to you. Listening to Bernie Sanders, and he is the man.
He is.
The name I need to mention, though, we need to prop for the next election isn't Hillary Clinton. It is Elizabeth Warren.
I don't disagree. Let me put it that way. I mean, if Hillary Clinton ends up the nominee, I will enthusiastically vote for her. But I would much rather, frankly, have Elizabeth Warren as president of the United States. That said, Elizabeth Warren, you know, she's only been in the Senate for a year. And Hillary's got a lot of...
Barack Obama was.
Say what?
About the same way Barack Obama was.
Well, yeah, good point. Okay, point taken. So you're calling to plug Elizabeth Warren? Is that basically it?
One of the plugs, and I love that digging on Ted Cruz.
Just wait 35 minutes or 40 minutes, and we will be hopefully, if Jerry Corsi shows up, we will be having that conversation, and it should be fascinating. Wayne, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to AM 760. Ted in Palos Hills, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Ted, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Listening to, thank you, by the way, for everything you do.
No need to thank me. Yeah. I'm pleased to be here.
Just listening to you talk to Bernie, about passing the bill to get us out of the sequester that's going to tax the rich. And Bernie also mentioned this, if everything has to go through Congress, because unless we do something about Congress, then nothing's going to get off the floor. Mm-hmm. Now Mike was just talking about this, in the last segment there too. I don't think that it's going to be possible to change the minds of the people that are on the constituents of the Tea Party politicians, the Republican politicians. There's just that study, although it was a left-leaning study, that just showed the people in Louisiana are blaming Barack Obama for Hurricane Katrina.
For Brownie, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, the people that have the ability to kind of sway their minds are going to be the politicians. And I don't think that they're as far gone as their constituents because they have a purpose. They're leading them for a reason to get them to the polls and to vote for, the wealthy who they represent.
We're just about out of time, Ted, your point.
They won't have to be so married to these to the wealthy and corporations if there is campaign finance reform.
Amen.
It seems like all hands on deck should be there before anything else gets done.
You're right. Here's the problem, Ted. The Supreme Court, Citizens United, knocked down the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform law. So the United States Supreme Court has ruled campaign finance reform illegal. And that's why you need to go to movetoamend.org and participate in the effort to amend the Constitution of the United States to say corporations are not people and money is not speech. Thanks, Ted.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the crash of 2016. Plot to take down America and what we can do to stop it is now available in your favorite bookseller's place for pre-order. Take it back to mainstream media, three hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, I will be picking up your phone calls in just a half a second, but just a couple of quick things that I wanted to share with you. There is a memo. Greg Palast is writing about this, but as are others, but you can read about this over at gregpalast.com. He says, when a little birdie dropped the Endgame memo through my window, its content was so explosive, so sick and plain evil, I just couldn't believe it. And basically what it is back on November 24th, 1997, specifically, Larry Summers passed out this memo saying, to Timmy Geithner, saying, let's get together with Goldman Sachs' John Corzine, Merrill Lynch, David Kaminsky, Bank of America's David Coulter, Citibank's John Reed, Chase Manhattan's Walter Shipley, and basically change the rules of the game. Let's deregulate the banking industry so that we can start making billions, you know, derivatives trading, all this kind of cool stuff. It's amazing. Larry Summers. And they literally use the word end game in the memo. What they wanted to do was take the World Trade Organization, you know, basically says that products are being deregulated all around the world. Like, you know, it used to be that we had dolphin-free tuna, you know, dolphin-safe tuna. You couldn't sell in the United States tuna that had, where they, because the dolphins always swim over schools of tuna. And so they would just swoop them all up in a giant net, kill the dolphins, and sell the tuna. And because nobody wants to eat dolphin meat, apparently. It doesn't taste all that good. And they're mammals. They're not fish. And so it's kind of like eating your dog, you know. And except that dolphins are a lot smarter than your dog. And so in any case, we you know, for 24 years, the Humane Society of the United States campaigned to make this illegal. And NAFTA actually was what blew that up. And you know, a fishing fleet company down in Mexico sued the United States, said, you can't do that. You can't say it's illegal to catch tuna that way because we catch tuna that way. In other words, everybody's got to go to the lowest common denominator. So what Larry Summers said was, let's organize an international campaign to do this, in, not just in the United States, but all across Europe, every place else, bring everybody to the lowest common denominator, not with regard to tuna, but with regard to banking. And thus, we got the crash of 2008. And this, you know, this just adds fuel to the fire for the, you know, I told you my new book, The Crash of 2016, is now available for pre-order. At Amazon and Powell's and Barnes and Noble and whatever your local bookstore is, you can just walk in and say, hey, you know, let me put an order in for it right now. There's a little video over at Amazon and I think on Powell's as well, and BNN. But it just this, you know, one more proof that I don't like being right about this, but I am right about this. You just wait. Here's another one. Those crazy conspiracy theory nuts, you know, the people who would call into talk shows and say, well, you know, I'm pretty sure I'm being followed. I mean, I get people who call into the program and say that. I'm pretty sure I'm being followed. You know, they I'm hearing loud clicks on my phone. And, you know, I found this contraption outside my front door the other day. It looks like they're using it to spy on me. And, you know, that sounds crazy, right? I mean, they're so sophisticated, they don't need to put clicks on your phone. Turns out that the COINTEL program, this was back in the 60s, but how do you know they're not still doing it? He said, you know, okay, they were wiretapping this anti-draft activist, you know, an anti-war protester, anti-draft protester. And this guy was talking out loud about how he figured that he was being followed around and wiretapped. And he was. And people were starting to take him seriously. So they said, let's turn him into a crackpot. Here is this is from the article over at Alternet. FBI spied New Left and lied about it. So conspiracy theorists would sound crazy. With a small push in the right direction, this is from the FBI memo. The agent said, the activist would start exhibiting obvious paranoid tendencies. This is the phrase of the FBI. That would completely, quote from the FBI, completely neutralize him in his several leadership capacities. So what they did was they built a spooky, or they suggested, let's build a spooky looking mechanism from a bicycle part and an old transistor radio and drop it near his front steps one night. And then quoting from the FBI memo, in the event he displayed the contraption to anyone, its crude construction would ultimately neutralize any allegation that originated or is being utilized by the FBI. End of quote from the FBI. In other words, this guy would show this, you know, bicycle pump attached to a transistor radio and say, see, the FBI left this on my front door. And they actually did. But then everybody would be able to say, come on, it's a bicycle pump hooked up to a transistor radio. And he would become an object of ridicule. very bizarre. David Sirota now has a piece out, just came out. Syndicated columns. No secret why Congress fears the NSA. Why? Because the NSA is wiretapping Congress, says David Sirota. I mean, there's some spooky stuff going on out there. There's absolutely spooky stuff going on there. It's going to get even spookier when Jerry Corsi shows up in 25 minutes. Anyhow, let's pick up some calls here. Donna in Columbia, California. Hey, Donna, what's on your mind today?
Oh, good afternoon, Tom. I just heard an interesting report this morning on the news, and it was through the LA Times, and Bloomberg.com also had it, that the banking lobbyists are working to remove the nonprofit tax exemption that credit unions effectively enjoy right now.
That's true.
And when that happens, then they will be turned into banks, and thus they eliminating the alternative to the Wall Street banks.
That's right. You are right.
That's a really disturbing, I mean, it's just the crushing of competition, basically.
Yes.
And who is the chairman of the banking committee in the Senate? Do you know?
I don't know. I'm sorry.
Okay. And I took your suggestion, and I called Dianne Feinstein with my disgust about how they're going to strictly interpret what qualifies as a journalist and the press.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for the heads up on that.
What kind of response did you get?
You can never talk to a human at Dianne Feinstein's office, either her California office or her Washington, D.C. office. It's always a recording.
Oh, interesting. So you left a message.
I left a message.
Good on you, Donna. And by the way, Tim Johnson is the, isn't he the South Dakota? Yeah, the Democrat from South Dakota. He's the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee.
Thank you.
So, and thanks Shano. He just tracked it down while we were on the air. So, Donna, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching the program there in Columbia, California. John in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I saw your basically commentary the other night on about journalists
mm-hmm.
and the definition of journalist, which is an act.
Yeah, what I'm saying, and just for people who don't know what we're talking about, Dianne Feinstein and others, Democrats and Republicans, they're trying to come up with a shield law to protect the First Amendment, the free press. But they're doing it wrong, in my opinion. They're saying, let's protect journalists. And they're defining journalists as people who have a job in journalism and get a paycheck from an organization that Congress recognizes. And I'm saying we've gone way beyond that. That, in fact, we were beyond that back when the First Amendment was written, that the press was not just people who had presses. There were pamphleteers and things, and they should have been and probably were protected as well. And that now journalism is an act, an acts of journalism, whether it's done by you, John, or by me, or by a reporter for The New York Times, always should be protected. So whether it's on Twitter or on Facebook or, published on the front page of The New York Times, an act of journalism deserves protection under the First Amendment. Back to you.
Yeah, I totally agree with your comment. The thing is, after I watched Manning's attorney talk earlier this morning, the interview they had, it really bothered me because he basically said what Manning was doing was basically being a journalist. Under basically the way I saw it, because they were not letting journalists really see what was going on. He basically exposed it, and so he was doing an act of journalism. That's in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but his attorney said, the military basically drew the line between journalism and traitor.
Yeah.
And he said that line could be easily crossed now.
Yeah, or that line has been fuzzed out. By the military. I didn't hear the or see the press conference. I don't know the words that the attorney used, so I can't say whether I agree with it or not. But and let's remind everybody that it's now Chelsea Manning, and she prefers to be referred to that way, and I'm going to honor that. I think that that's worthy of honoring. When she released that information back some years ago to WikiLeaks, whether it was an act of journalism or whether it was an act of whistleblowing, I'm not sure. I would say that whistleblowing and journalism and press are so closely related that any press shield law should be associated with a whistleblower shield law, and they should be equally protected because they're both necessary for a free press. So if that's the way that Chelsea Manning's attorney constructed it, then I would agree. Does that make sense, John?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. I totally agree with you.
Okay. Thanks a lot. We got to take a break here. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And my new book, The Crash of 2016, is now available for pre-order. So get in line. Welcome back. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can get and give a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of war, women who had actually seen somebody die in front of them in South Sudan, at GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. And Ellen, I have news for you. Oh, I got to put her on the air first. That always helps, doesn't it? Hi, Ellen.
Hi, you have news for me.
I do, yeah. My new book, The Crash of 2016, is pre-released today officially on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Powell's, and in any bookstore in America, somebody can go in and order an advance copy of The Crash of 2016 by Tom Hartman, so I wanted to let you know, because I know you've seen it.
Oh, wow, and I put it in somebody's hand who you asked me to, so...
Cool. Hopefully. Yeah, you've been helping me get blurbs for it, and I appreciate that.
Okay.
So, what's going on in the world today?
Well, the president, as you know, went to two colleges, and he talked about students and families should have a limit on debt. College should be funded based on how well they perform, and that means do those people get jobs, are they trained, that kind of thing, and that is where they should get federal and state funding from. The president also made a very, very quick stop among a huge thunderstorm or rainstorm in Seneca Falls. The 150th anniversary of the Declaration of Sentiments is Monday. That is women's rights. He gave a copy of the Ledbetter bill, as you know. That has been a huge issue. Just a little side, a friend of mine, Ann Browday, wrote a book called Radical Spirits. Most people are unaware that when the Declaration of Sentiments was signed 150 years ago this coming Monday, there were these little spirit wrappings on the table. The table lives in the Smithsonian Museum.
Wow. That's amazing.
I'm sure the president wasn't talking about that today.
Yeah, probably not.
I know you wrote an op-ed today. We have it on our site, Talk Radio News. It's all over the place, of course, as your op-ed pieces are, about Chelsea Manning, former Bradley Manning, and about how she deserves to have treatment.
Yes.
A lot of a friend of mine, a gay psychiatrist, who's done a lot of work on this, Jack Dresser, has written and done a lot on this, as you have too.
Yeah, this is a topic that I've learned about personally. One of my now nephews is a transgendered man, or a transgender man, I guess is how you would say it. And you know, we learned a lot about this by watching our niece become our nephew. And I have a lot of respect for Bradley Manning for Chelsea Manning, excuse me, for being willing to stand up and say that. And I think that she deserves not only that respect, but she deserves. I was astounded by the number of media sources today who reported how she wants to be referred to using feminine pronouns and then used masculine pronouns to report that.
It kind of blows your mind.
It disappointed me.
It disappointed me as well. The Justice Department filed suit in Texas. They filed suits on the Voting Rights Act and particularly the ID law. However, they also said that they intend to file in a few days or a couple weeks, they didn't give a date, on the redistricting issue in Texas. So that was filed today by the Justice Department.
Wow. Good on them. Good on Eric Holder.
Yes, very good. The State Department says that they cannot conclusively determine if chemical weapons were used in Syria. The United Nations has tried to get people in there. Obviously, the Syrian government will not let people in to look at some of the bodies, to talk to the physicians, that kind of thing. We do have a reporter on the board there, on the border there, and so we don't know where they're going to go with this, but we do know that United Nations is trying to get somebody in and having a difficult time with it.
Well, and France is saying, you know, if we get any evidence of this, let's go in and take names and kick butt. You know, let's use violence.
Yeah, well.
We'll see. but
exactly. Former congressman in San Francisco, Mayor Filner, looks like he is going to resign tomorrow.
Thank God.
He has to go with a board on this. He just got out of 2 weeks of treatment. They probably hit him very hard, I would hope, on his responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. This is, that falls into the category of thank God. Let's get on with the, you know, let's get over
on.
The circus.
Right.
Yes.
Speaking of Syria, UNICEF says that the number of refugees is about 1 million with children. Under 18 years old, just 1 million.
There's 1 million under 18 Syrian refugees?
That's right. I know. It's a huge number.
Wow.
And as you know, they're crowded in places that can't take crowds. Turkey,
yeah.
Jordan,
yeah.
Lebanon,
yeah.
And even parts of Israel, Palestine.
Yeah, amazing.
It's just quite unbelievable. The National Organization for Marriage.
This is the right-wing crackpot anti-gay group you're talking
that's
about?
The right-wing crackpot anti-gay group.
Okay.
They are trying to have their general counsel removed in Iowa. The Iowa Ethics Board did not grant their petition.
Wait a minute. Their general counsel. You mean their lawyer, their head lawyer?
Not theirs. I'm sorry. The lawyer, there's an ethics board that deals with things like gay marriage, hospital visits, all that kind of stuff. The National Organization for Marriage petitioned to this group to have the general counsel and, I guess, the person's also executive director of this group removed, and the ethics board said nothing doing.
Okay, so the NOM loses another one.
They lost a big another one.
Okay, we applaud that.
Back to just Bradley Manning for one quick second. It looks as if the military is saying they are not going to be paying for any hormone, sex change operation, et cetera. As you know, this has been a major issue in Massachusetts where, in fact, a court ruled that they did have to pay.
Yes.
Well,
gender dysphoria, which used to have a different and somewhat more pejorative name, is listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the EPA. It's the DSM. So it is officially a category of a medical condition. And therefore, you would think qualifies for treatment in a medical facility, whether it's in Leavenworth or anywhere else.
Right. So that's absolutely true. And one other quick one. The Huffington Post today came out and said the Republican lawmakers are weekly meeting to try and end the president's health care program.
Yeah. Good luck on that to them. Ellen Ratner, but thanks for the heads up on that. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And this is remarkable. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican from Canada, who pretends he's from Texas. There we go. Oh, Canada. Thank you. Thank you, Shana. Senator Ted Cruz was asked about his birth certificate. He released it. And there are some comments on this. I believe this was over this is from Daily Kos. Nice try, Raphael Edward. The person over at Daily Kos who wrote this said, took some time yesterday to inspect your alleged birth certificate from Senator Cruz. It was a crude, cartoonish GIF file. Actual birth certificates in the 1970s were printed on birch bark. The red seal is blank. Authentic Canadian birth certificates show a Mountie chasing a moose, making off with a six-pack of Molson. The font, it's all wrong. There's no mention of hockey anywhere on this certificate. Also, a proton scan reveals no trace of tar sand revenue, and that stuff gets all over everything. So, anyway, it goes on and on from there. So I thought, you know, let's ask the real expert on this stuff. Dr. Jerome Corsi wrote the book that started the whole thing about Barack Obama. It's called Where's the Birth Certificate? The Case That Barack Obama Is Not Eligible to Be President. It's still available in hardcover over at your favorite book site. and Jerome Corsi. Whoop, hang on just a minute. Clicked the wrong button. Sorry about that, Mike. Dr. Jerome Corsi is
Tom.
On the line. Hey, Jerry, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So, first of all, Ted Cruz, he just comes right out and says, okay, my dad is not an American, and I was born in Canada, and yet I still have the right to run for president. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, Ted, what Ted Cruz is trying to do is to very cleverly use the same argument supporters of Barack Obama were using for Barack Obama. So I'm not saying yet it's appropriate or inappropriate. It's what he's doing.
Which is to say, because his mom was an American, he's an American.
Yeah, or the idea is that if you were qualified at birth to be an American citizen, then you are a natural-born citizen,
right,
making that the definition. The argument, of course, is an argument that the standard defining natural-born citizen is not that you are eligible to be a citizen at birth, but according to a philosopher, a political philosopher at the time of the Constitution, when the founding documents were written, a guy named Vatel, French philosopher, natural-born citizen meant two U.S. citizen parents when you were born and born in the United States.
But this guy wasn't even an American. He was French.
French, yes. But the American, Thomas Jefferson, Franklin, Washington, borrowed.
We've had several presidents who did not have two American parents.
Was there an American president? The main one who...
I think it wasn't Jackson.
I don't believe. I'd have to go back and look.
Zachary Taylor. I mean, there were several.
Some of the early presidents also were grandfathered by the way Article 1, Section 2 was written, saying that if you were a U.S. citizen at the time...
Oh, but these people were born long after the writers of the Constitution were dead.
Yeah, but they were... they traced back to parents who were citizens when the Constitution...
Okay, but to cut to the chase here, are you being consistent in... Are you now coming out and saying that Ted Cruz is not eligible to run for president of the United States?
Two things, Tom. I'm saying, one, what I said from the beginning, namely, we need a Supreme Court decision on this to define what is a natural-born citizen. I'm saying, second...
Well, wait a minute. You were on our program a long time ago when this first came out. You weren't saying, I want a Supreme Court decision. You were just saying Barack Obama should be kicked out of the White House.
But if you listen to me finish.
Okay.
Said, number one, we should have a Supreme Court decision on this to set it. Secondly, if you're going to apply the Vattel standard, which I believe applies to Obama, then Cruz is not eligible. If you apply the more liberal standard that the supporters of Barack Obama use, namely eligible to be a citizen when you're born, then Cruz has an argument. I don't think it's a correct argument. I think that Vattel's definition was the one the founders meant. If the founders had meant to say someone who is eligible to be a citizen at birth.
So let me get this right. We're talking with Jerry Corsi, Jerome Corsi, who wrote Where's the Birth Certificate, the case that Barack Obama is not eligible to be president, that kind of kicked off this whole hysteria back in the day. And when it was the black guy in the White House, you were on this program. I mean, you were saying Barack Obama is not eligible to be president. You weren't
correct.
Saying we should investigate it. You weren't saying there's a liberal standard by which it's possible.
They're in the book. But to be absolutely clear on this, I'm saying...
But now that it's a white guy, you're saying, well, maybe we should ask the Supreme Court.
Let me answer this.
Yeah.
I'm saying, well, my opinion, I'm saying that Vattel's standard is the correct standard, and under that standard, Obama's not eligible and Cruz is not eligible. I'm saying neither one are eligible.
Period.
I'm also saying, period.
But just a second ago, you were saying, no, maybe we need to have, or there's a more liberal interpretation, or let's ask the Supreme Court.
I don't think the liberal interpretation is correct. My personal opinion, I don't think it's correct.
Okay, so are you going to write a book called The Birth Certificate Stinks, the case that Ted Cruz should not be president?
If Ted Cruz persists, at some point in the debate, I will enter and say that Ted Cruz does not apply under the Vattel standard, which I believe is the correct standard.
Okay, and in that case, now that standard that you're talking about is whether your father is an American citizen.
No,
you want both parents.
The Patel standard is both parents, U.S. citizen at the time you're born.
Okay, so but
born in the United States.
But again, that disqualifies a number of people who've already been president of the United States, and they were president of the United States back. And I believe it's a total of eight of them. It's at least six of them, and they were president of the United States back at some of them as early as times when.
Tom, I'm not sure that that's the case. They would have to go back and research the ones you have in mind.
Well, the last time you were on this show, I read you the list. I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me right now. But
remember, we'd have to go back and look at the list because remember, there is an exception in Article 1, Section 2, that grandfathers, those who became or were citizens when the Constitution was ratified, because many of those people,
Chester Arthur,
born and their parents had not been
James
born
Buchanan.
In the United States.
Woodrow Wilson, Herbert Hoover
were born.
All of these guys had mothers who were born outside the United States.
But, Tom, it's not where the mothers were born. It's whether the mothers were U.S. citizens when the future president was born. You could be born outside the United States as a parent, as under Vattel's standard, as long as you were a citizen when the child
so,
was born.
Okay, so when it was the black guy, it was case closed. You know, black and white here, you know.
I said because his father was not a citizen when he was born. Barack Obama was not eligible, and I thought the Patel
standard
was correct.
But if it's Buchanan or Hoover or Wilson or Chester Arthur or Ted Cruz, then...
I'm saying with Ted Cruz.
Realize how bad this sounds, Jerry?
His father was not a citizen when he was born. He's not eligible to run for president.
Okay, so are you going to come out and just explicitly say Ted Cruz should just hang it up?
Tom, I've already said it in print.
Okay.
It's already in print. In fact, I said this not only about Cruz. I've said it about whether or not it applies to... Others like
final question. We're running out of time here, Jerry. What would it take to prove to you that Obama was actually born in America?
That's not the issue, Tom. His father wasn't a citizen when he was born.
Okay, so you're no longer concerned about where he's born.
The
playing field has kind of shifted.
Arguments, Tom, I said the first and completely disqualifying condition was his father was not born in the United States. The same. He was not a citizen, I'm sorry, he was not a citizen when he was born.
Right.
The same disqualification applies to Cruz.
Okay, but not to Buchanan or Arthur or to Herbert Hoover.
I think their parents were citizens when they were born.
Okay, well, we'll have to check into that. At least there's some consistency here, Jerry Corsi. Dr. Jerome Corsi, author of Where's the Birth Certificate? His new book coming out about who killed Kennedy. You can check that out. Jerry, thank you for being with us today.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, that was interesting. What does it take to prove that? Oh, Ted Cruz? Really? We'll be right back. Well, I have to tip my hat to Jerry Corsi a little bit. At least, I mean, he started out saying, well, you know, I've been asking for the Supreme Court to litigate, you know, maybe Ted Cruz could be run for, but then he finally said, no, Ted Cruz shouldn't be running for president. So, but still, I mean, it's like isn't this a joke now? Doug in Jamul, California. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Tom. You okay now? You're all well?
I think so. What do you mean?
What's wrong with you? Why are you saying black this, black guy this, black? What's it have to do with being black?
Well, you tell me, Doug, why is it that as soon as we got a black guy in the White House, all of a sudden there were all these people who were saying, for the first time in American history, maybe he's not qualified to be president. Maybe we should remove him from the White House.
Well, what's the big difference between how Barack Obama handled the situation and Ted Cruz? What's the difference? You be objective. What's the difference?
I think they both submitted a birth certificate for our evaluation. I mean, Ted Cruz's birth certificate was issued by the government of Canada, and Barack Obama's was issued by the government of the United States and the state of Hawaii, but unless you have some different observation.
Of course. How long did it take Obama? Ted Cruz just came out and gave out his birth certificate, just like I would, just like you would. How long did it take Obama until he got to Hawaii, and then the good governor of Hawaii sounded like handed him his birth certificate? That took a long time, didn't it?
His the kind of birth certificate that you get when you ask for a copy of your birth certificate, and I got to tell you, I don't have the original of my birth certificate. I don't think most people do. You don't walk around with it since you were born, right? The copy of his birth certificate that he got from the state of Hawaii was on the White House website for a long, long time. You guys just weren't happy with it. You said, "Well, it's not the long form. It's not the right one."
You didn't answer the question.
Yeah. So do you think, Doug, that Barack Obama is not eligible to be president?
I'm saying, what was the difference? And you can't even say that it took Obama like 2 years before he took care of the question.
Okay, so is that proof? So, Doug, is that proof in your mind that Barack Obama shouldn't be president?
My proof is that, hey, he is the president. He got to Hawaii, got his birth certificate. There's those that believe, like Sheriff Joe Arpaio, that it's a forgery, that
right.
The birth certificate is a forgery.
Right.
And it won't go forward. Now, this is you won't even say that Ted Cruz just came out and showed his birth certificate. Barack Obama.
I started by saying that. I'm not sure it's a real birth certificate because there's no Molson and there's no Moose on the birth certificate, but, you know.
Do you actually believe in the natural born citizen clause as it was carried over from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution? Do you see evidence that both parents was debated inside the 1987 notes of the Constitutional Convention? Do you have any evidence of that?
I don't know what you're talking about, Doug.
You're talking about, you don't agree with
1987 was just 15 years ago.
I'm talking about the 1787 Constitutional Convention, notes
right.
of the Constitution, which you've mentioned
right.
before. Were there
yeah, what they wanted to do was make sure that no European, the biggest concern, and if you go back to the Constitutional Convention and the debate, the big concern was that European royalty might have enough money to come over to the United States and promote themselves in a way that would cause people to vote for them. And they didn't want anybody who had loyalty to another country to be president of the United States. In fact, in the election of 1800, I recommend you read Dan Sisson's brilliant book, The Revolution of 1800. It's just a scholarly analysis of this issue. In the election of 1800, one of the biggest issues that wasn't an issue, in other words, one of the biggest issues that was sort of like this birth certificate thing that everybody was talking about and yet really didn't have any legal legs, was whether Thomas Jefferson was more loyal to France than, because he was good friends with Lafayette and he lived in France for a while as our George Washington's envoy to France, whether Jefferson was more loyal to France or whether, on the other hand, John Adams, I mean, that was the charge that was being made by the Adams camp, or whether John Adams was more loyal to the British than he was loyal to America, which was the charge that was being made by the Jefferson loyalists. And in both cases, the candidates themselves were disavowing the kind of crazies in their camp, but that was it was an issue of loyalty. It wasn't, and there was never any clear definition of what this means. And I'm just astounded that you want to relitigate it. I'm just astounded. Doug, thanks for the call. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Steve, birth certificate issue, really?
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom. Just wanted to jump into this, but on the birth certificate, but things are getting crazy back in my home state of Madison, or Wisconsin, rather.
Okay.
They arrested 300 or so for singing the other day, so.
Yes. Yeah, we reported on that. It's.
Yeah, I saw the guy. That's really good.
Yeah.
Our intelligence service in our country is pretty darn good. And the NSA, they seem to be knowing whatever goes on in our country. The FBI does too. The CIA.
Yeah, it's gotten to the point where they pretty much know if that was a sneeze or a fart. I mean, it's.
Exactly. Now, in regards to our president, Mr. Barack Obama, when he was beginning to, his campaign initially getting off the ground, doesn't somebody come to realize that if he was illegitimate and it wasn't even a viable candidate, that this would have been sniffed out by the NSA, the CIA, the FBI.
Yeah,
the
of course,
Service.
It's a non-issue. It's yeah. and that's why That's why I was just, I was fascinated. I mean, you know, when Ted Cruz issued his birth certificate, I thought, oh boy, here we go. And that's why I wanted to get Jerry Corsi on, because he's the guy who started this whole thing, you know, or at least he takes credit for it. He wrote the book, literally wrote the book. He also wrote the Swift Boat Veterans book. He got that one started. And so I thought, you know, let's see what he has to say. And he was, I would characterize what he was doing, at least for the first three quarters of that interview, as trying to weasel around it to say, well, maybe the white guy, we'll have a different set of standards than we did for Barack Obama. But at the end, he kind of came around to know Ted Cruz shouldn't be president. So I guess we've got to give him credit for that. Steve, thanks for the call. It is a strange time. We've got other things going on in the news as well. We will get to those as we continue through the hour. It's 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and only slightly unbalanced.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And yes, I wrote a book called The Crash of 2016, and it goes into pre-release today. Very, very rapidly ugly, the good. President Barack Obama, almost 3 years after he first promised to do so, the commander-in-chief will soon install between 20 and 50 American-made solar panels on the roof of the White House. President Obama announced a plan to set up solar panels at the White House in 2010, but that plan fell into the back burner during all the drama in his first term. But as activist Bill McKibben said about the president's plan, better late than never. The United States still has a long way to go before we catch up with countries like Germany that have turned solar energy into an art. But hopefully the president's example will jumpstart the rest of Washington into tackling renewable energy head on. The bad. Louisiana Republicans. According to a new poll, Pelican State Republicans think Barack Obama is more responsible for Brownie's poor response to Hurricane Katrina than George W. Bush. Seriously, no joke. The poll, which was conducted by the Public Policy Polling Center, found that while 29% of Louisiana Republicans blamed Obama for FEMA's disastrous handling of the 2005 hurricane, only 28% blamed good old W. A full 44% of those polled were, quote-unquote, unsure about who was more responsible. What gives with the Louisiana Republicans? Does this clip mean nothing to you?
Again, I want to thank you all for... And Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. The FEMA director's working 24.
Heck of a job, Brownie. And the very, very ugly, Rush Limbaugh's. The murder of Australian baseball player Chris Lane by three Oklahoma teens who, quote, just wanted to see what it was like to kill someone, end quote, is an unspeakable tragedy. While most sensible media coverage of the case is focused on the terrifying idea of thrill killing, Rush Limbaugh is trying to use this tragedy to ramp up race hatred because two of the accused murderers happen to be black. On yesterday's broadcast of his radio show, he ranted and raved about one of the suspects' obsession with rap music and blasted the mainstream media's double standard coverage of the Lane murder. Take a listen.
If you go to the Facebook page of one of the suspects, you'll notice how often the suspect quotes rappers. Especially rap lyrics about killing people. It's worse than a double standard. This is a purposeful, willful ignoring of the exact racial components, but in reverse, that happened in the Trayvon Martin shooting.
Right. If the Chris Lane case were Trayvon Martin in reverse, Oklahoma would have to have had Alec create a law that allows young teenagers to kill people if they feel like they need to try it out. But Oklahoma didn't do that, and Rush is just exploiting this awful tragedy to play on his audience's racial bigotry. And that is very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. I mean, how do you get there? Robert in Colton, California. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Robert.
Thank you for taking my call. But anyway, I'd like to agree with those other two guys that was there. I have not read this Corsi book, which I'd like to read because I don't make opinion without noting the facts. But I want to talk about the citizenship a little bit here. My father came to the United States when he was 6 years old, and his father did not become a U.S. citizen. If he would have become, my dad would have became one, too, because anybody under 18 is automatically a citizen if the father takes the oath. Well, he never did. So my dad was in the United States 46 years. He was 53 years old, and he went down in front of a
judge. What's your point, Robert?
And he called him a U.S. citizen. Well, when he came home, I was 15 years old at the time, and my sister was 13, and my brother was 10. I was the oldest.
Right. What's your
anyway,
point?
Anyway, when he got his citizenship that day, that was the day I became a U.S.
Now, citizen. Robert, you know, what's your point?
Well, the point is the 14th Amendment, when you read the thing about naturalization and birth, the baby that's born here is not under the jurisdiction of the United States. It's under the jurisdiction of the parents. So if the parents are from another country, the baby is automatically a citizen of the country their parents are from.
No, the 14th Amendment, and this is actually one of the areas where I have some ambivalence about, you know, a constitutional amendment, but the 14th Amendment says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. That's the entire first sentence of the 14th Amendment. So what part about that don't you get?
He's not even a resident of anything. Nobody knows he's here.
Who is this he you're talking about? Ted Cruz? Are we talking about Ted Cruz here?
Well, Ted Cruz, see, what's wrong with Ted Cruz was his father became a citizen after he was born.
His dad was a Cuban citizen when he was born.
Right, but he wasn't a U.S. citizen.
And he was born in Canada. So are you saying that Ted Cruz should not be eligible to be president of the United States?
Well, see, the law says to be a president, you've got to be a citizen, 30 years old, and born on the mainland.
No, it doesn't say that. It says you must be a natural-born citizen, but nowhere is what a natural-born citizen means defined in our founding documents. So are you saying, I just want to know for the record, Robert, are you saying that Ted Cruz is not eligible to be president of the United States?
Yeah, but on the mainland, see, all the presidents...
No, yes, sir. It's a yes or no question. Then we can debate it. But I just need to know your position. Are you saying that Ted Cruz is not eligible to be president of the United States?
No, he's not.
He's not eligible to be president of the United States. Okay. Well, at least you're consistent. Robert, thank you for the call. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom.
What's on your mind, Charles?
Oh, well, a couple of things. First of all... As far as this Ted Cruz thing, I think what he's just trying to do is test the water. If he does want to run for president, he is going to get a backlash from not only Democrats, but I'm sure some Republicans.
I don't think so, because the Democrats all know that the whole birth certificate thing was just nonsense. It was just, you know, it was race baiting and you know, the weakest excuse they could find to try to impeach the guy, because they always try to impeach a Democratic president. They tried, you know, 16 different ways to get Bill Clinton before they finally caught him in a well, I don't want to say it on the air, but you know what I'm talking about. And we didn't lie, let's say. But they're not going to do that to Ted Cruz because, you know, the Democrats don't think it was legitimate to begin with, and the Republicans all knew that it was just a scam.
Okay. Well, my second thing is this. As far as this country is concerned, George Bush is the one that destroyed it, and Barack Obama has been trying, and progressives as well as Democrats have been trying to bring it back. Now, my biggest thing is, Why isn't the House trying to get a jobs bill in there?
That's because the House is controlled by the Republicans.
The Tea Party.
Very simple answer. The Republicans control the House of Representatives, and the Republicans want to destroy this country so that they can blame it on on that black guy in the White House, on Barack Obama. I mean, this is, and I say that explicitly because I do think that there is a large element of racism in this thing. I think they've been playing that from the get-go. And you go back and you look at this meeting that they had at the – I've lost it in my paperwork here – this meeting that they had at the Caucus Room restaurant back the night on January 20th, 2009, the night that Barack Obama was, you know, out dancing with his wife as he was sworn in that day. And these guys got together in the caucus room restaurant and said, okay, how do we keep this guy from having any successes whatsoever? And you know, Paul Ryan and Kevin McCarthy and Eric Cantor and Jeb Hensarling and Pete Hoekstra and John Kyle Jim DeMint, all these Republicans, they got together with Newt Gingrich, who came on this program and admitted it right here on this program. And Frank Luntz said, okay, we're going to, in fact, which one was it? I think it was Sessions, Pete Sessions was one of them, said, we're going to imitate the Taliban. And, you know, we're going to take them down.
Well, let's not let them forget this. And let them know that we're going to always remember those names.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm totally with you, Charles, and that's why I keep bringing it up, because the media will not report on this, that these guys have been, you know, they literally called themselves the Taliban and said, we're going to take this president down, and that was the night he was inaugurated. And they have been doing it for 6 years now, going on 6 years, and it's just wrong. It's wrong. Sam, Charles, thanks for the call. Sam in Woodstock, Illinois. Got a minute to the break. Sam, what's on your mind?
With this recent chemical attack on Syria and the rocket launching into Lebanon, any predictions in the future? I know we kind of set the standard saying, you know, not to use chemical weapons, but it'd be consequences. I'm a little concerned at this point.
I'm very concerned. I have no predictions. I have no idea which way this is going to go. But what I do know is that a lot of this is the consequence of a U.S. foreign policy over the last, well, basically since World War II, that has been, arguably since World War I, when we first divided up the Middle East, that has been largely driven by the military-industrial complex, and that instead of being genuine foreign aid, has been military aid. The one exception to that was the Marshall Plan, but that's not what we did in the Middle East. We didn't do the Marshall Plan in the Middle East. We didn't, you know, help them build their industries and help them build roads and hospitals and schools. Instead, we started sending them weapons. And gee whiz, they're having wars. What a surprise. And we were propping up their dictators. And when they tried to have, you know, when they tried to overthrow dictators, you know, we supported their dictators. And, or, you know, when they democratically elected somebody, we would kick them out and put a, we installed Saddam Hussein in Iraq, you know, against a democratically elected guy. So, Sam, I think it's a mess, and I think it's a mess that we helped create. And I frankly don't know what to do about it. I wish I did. But, you know, these are very, very complex situations that don't have simple answers.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Which is all the more reason, frankly, why, you know, we need to be having serious conversations about these issues and thinking twice about military or anyone else. I need a double dose of Edison Factor here. Forgetting Hess's first name. Was it Herman Hess? No, it wasn't. He was the philosopher. In any case, I was just going off on this rant about birth certificates. We'll get back, or about Homeland rather. Rudolph Hess. That's right. Here, this, we had a caller a few minutes ago who was saying, you know, what about the Department of Homeland Security? And I pointed out that the Germans always, I mean, 1,000 years, the Germans always referred to Der Vaterland or Vaterland, the Fatherland. Germany was always referred to as the Fatherland. And Rudolf Hess and Adolf Hitler looked at the Zionist movement and said, you know, the Zionists talk about a homeland. And, you know, and there's this real sense of identity among Jews. We need to do this among Germans. And so they started, and so in 1938, I believe it was, maybe it was 36, in the Nuremberg, the giant Nuremberg rally, which is really when Hitler came out, right? Must have been 36. Rudolf Hess introduced him to the assembled crowd, to the multitude. This is the one that Leni Riefenstahl did the incredible documentary on. And Rudolf Hess introduced him and said, you know, I give to you Adolf Hitler, thanks to the Führer, Dank an zu Führer, thanks to the Führer, to thank you to Hitler. He has created this homeland, a homeland for all Germans all over the world, alles Deutsche über die ganze Welt. And Heimat zu sein, a homeland for us. Heimat is the German word for homeland. And this is when the Hitler administration started referring to Germany as the homeland. Here it is.
Dank Ihrer Führung
Thanks to the
wird
Führer.
Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen, Heimat zu sein.
Heimat zu sein.
Heimat zu sein für alle Deutschen der Welt. Alle Hitler! Sieg Höhl! Sieg Höhl!
This is the real guy, and this is the real start. And that's when Germany started using the word homeland to describe themselves instead of fatherland. And prior to the George Bush administration, prior to 2001, Americans never used the word homeland. We never used that word. And when George Bush said, we're going to consolidate all of the police agencies and call it homeland security, I mean, I'd lived in Germany. My mentor, Gottfried Mueller, who's now, he died at the age of 96, you know, in the previous decade, some years ago, he met Rudolf Hess. And I just a chill went through me when George W. Bush started talking about homeland. So, anyhow, Jenny, in American Falls, Idaho, you wanted to talk about Chelsea Manning?
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for answering my call. The issue that I would like to address is traitors, because Chelsea and Ed Snowden have been stereotyped as being traitors. And I've called in several times. I talked to our esteemed Bernie Sanders a couple times, and I have a question, and, I feel like, I revere Bernie Sanders and Dennis Kucinich like I did JFK when I was in high school. And, without them, I feel like we would really be in a mess. But the thing is, why isn't our Congress doing something about the crimes when they're lied to? If they're lied to...
Yeah.
If somebody lies.
No, I'm totally with you, Jenny. I asked this question yesterday. I asked it in our newscast today. We've been repeating it every half hour. Why is it that Chelsea Manning, why is she getting 35 years in prison for revealing the crimes of other people, and the people whose crimes she revealed are not going to prison, they're all now multimillionaires as a consequence of their participation in the Bush regime. I find it astounding. Jenny, thank you for calling and pointing that out. Ron, I don't have a city for you. But where are you calling from?
North Carolina, Smithfield, North Carolina.
Great. So what's on your mind?
I just want to know if you remember a few years ago that this Ukrainian jumped from a Russian ship to an American ship and asked for asylum, and they finally gave him back to the Russians, but it turned out that his parents had migrated to the United States, and he was born, and then they went back to the Ukraine. And when the United States found that out, they had to have Russia to give him back because he's a citizen. And his parents were not citizens. He was born here.
Okay. I'm sorry. I got distracted just a second ago by my screen here. I missed your last sentence. What did you say?
I said, do you remember this story?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
It was all in the news.
Yeah.
And Russia had to give him back because he was born here, even though his parents weren't.
Yeah, that's the 14th Amendment. It's called birthright citizenship. If you're born in the land, then you're a citizen. So, Ron, thank you for the call. I'm sorry, I don't remember the details of that. Sue in Morgan, Pennsylvania. Sue, we have a minute left in the show. It's yours.
Okay, Tom. Reagan began the Social Security disability denials to build financial coffers. Takes anywhere from 2 to 5 years to be approved. In the majority of cases, if you have a fatal disease, two members of my church did. They didn't live long enough to be approved. Hmm. And I believe I read it, Mother Jones Magazine.
Okay, so this whole thing of taking a long time and being very difficult to get SSI benefits began during the Reagan administration.
During the Reagan administration.
Yeah, this is what Louise says she's going to put on my tombstone. It all began with Reagan,
It did. They rubber stamped 7 out of 10 automatic denials and 3 that will be looked at.
Wow. Okay. Sue, thank you for the information. I'll have to verify that. Anyhow, just a heads up. I've got a new book coming out, a little self-promotion here, I guess. It's called The Crash of 2016, and it's available for pre-order right now. If you are interested, I will be sharing with you bits and pieces of it as we go on. Thanks so much for being with us today. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. It's not a spectator sport. It requires active participation. So find a group of like-minded people and occupy something. Tag your it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.